Our speaker today is L. John Hoover, Ph.D., PMP, President of Business Performance Group, a firm focused on improving performance for private sector enterprises by supporting strategic business planning, business capture, and project management. Dr. Hoover has more than 30 years of experience with strategic business planning, business startups, and executive management in the public and private sectors. He's held senior management president and vice president positions with major consulting firms and startup companies. He has operational experience leading organizations with over 300 people. In addition, he has served as a founder, corporate officer for startup firms and the technology and IT consulting, including business intelligence and knowledge management and management consulting, and firms with revenues of $700 million. All startup firms have made 20% plus profit and have been successfully sold for investors. His private sector market experience includes finance, energy, chemical, environment, defense contractors, and information technology firms. Dr. Hoover earned his B.S. degree cum laude in engineering mechanics and Ph.D. degree in nuclear engineering from the Pennsylvania State University in 1968. Dr. Hoover has also been involved in Golf for Kids fundraiser held at Polo, benefiting youth development through the Forsyth County YMCA, and I think he'll talk a little bit about that. But please welcome John Hoover.
Thank you. One of the things that I really appreciated about Heinz inviting me to do this was that it really forces you to go back and to look at your life and to reflect upon it and to identify those few things that have really been important in your life and have really made a difference for you. And I am old enough at this point that I have notes. And I hopefully have glasses so I can read my notes. I do have them. Let me talk first about the why. And I serve on the YMCA Board of Directors for our local Y. And one, two, three, four, five of the people at that table are involved with the why. Let me ask a question about the why. How many people in this room learn to swim at a YMCA? Yeah, it's just amazing. Every time this question gets asked, how many of us, that was our first experience, the way that we learned to swim, and where we did exercise. But our why is a lot more than just exercise. It's about healthy living. We have people that come in and talk about how to avoid diabetes and good eating habits and routine exercise activities. And I got invited on the Y board by my friend Manny Enriquez, must have been about 5 or 6 years ago. And the Y director at that point, we have a program called Why It Matters, and the brochure is, there are several of them on each table. And we raise money that goes to kids, to help kids go to sports programs, participate in mentoring, go to camp. And these are all Forsyth County kids from needy families. And I'm sure you would all agree that if there's one group that we really want to help grow and develop, it's our kids. You know, as evidenced by what Mark said regarding education and what's happening now in the state of Georgia regarding education. So take a look at this. This will give you an idea of what the Y does beyond just providing exercise opportunities. The Y Golf Tournament, we started 4 years ago. This will be our fifth year. There is also an announcement, kind of a hold the date, that's on each table, a couple copies of it. This year will be September 15th. It's a Monday. It's held here at Polo. We get record turnouts. We had 130 golfers last year. We raised $30,000 last year. In total, the Why It Matters program raised $88,000, I think, is the right number. And I had a great partner in doing it this year, Ron Graybow. And in the past 3 years, I had been the lead for it. Somehow, we managed to convince Ron to take the lead, and then at the same time, he permitted me to be his partner in this, which was great. But Ron brought to bear a whole different set of golfers and contacts that he has to really help us generate more enthusiasm and commitment. And we took a big step forward. The previous year, I think we raised about 22,000, and we moved up to 30,000 this year. And we got a lot of positive comments about what a great event this is, and that it's not just about raising money. There's a lot of camaraderie and, you know, friends that that come to it. So take a look at that. There will eventually, the full brochure will be produced. It'll be here at the club, and we'll announce it in the newspaper. And please consider participating this year. Okay. And I'll switch and talk about lessons learned, maybe not exactly in the order that Hines gave me. But when I went through and did this, what happened was I thought about my life and I realized that there were really four key things that influenced me and made a real difference in my life. And afterwards, as I was sitting, I remembered I had read a book in the 1990s called The Fourfold Way. And it's written by a woman, Anjali Arian, A-R-R-I-E-N. And she had studied cultures and religions around the world, and she found four common themes that were in almost all religions and cultural. And the themes are teacher, visionary, warrior, and caretaker. And my words that fit within those, the things that influenced me were family, innovation, commitment, and play your strength. And they kind of lined up with my life. I'll talk first about family. And the way I got my PhD was, it was my mother's influence. I come from a family of true Judeo-Christian family.
Can you speak closer to
mine? Sure, sorry.
Not right on, but just closer to it. Thank you.
I like to wander around. A little bit too much nervous energy. I come from a family with nine children. And we were encouraged to have dialogue around the dining room table and to express our opinions. But if you had an opinion, you had to have something to back it up. And if you did not, my mother would send you to the World Book. And you would go look something up and come back with some dialogue that was a little bit more meaningful. She never said a word to any of us about get good grades, you know, or do this or do that regarding education. But of nine children in my family, three of them have PhDs. Two have master's degrees. And trust me, we came, like most of the people in this room, from humble roots. I had to work in order to get through college. I used to work at night at a supermarket, stacking the shelves, all the kinds of things that I'm sure many of you did in order to complete your education. And I got my BS degree, and I was walking down the hallway, and there was a sign on the bulletin board that Atomic Energy Commission Fellowship. It would pay $200 a month, your rent and everything. This was 1964. You could live on that. And they would pay all your books and your tuition. And I said, wow, somebody will actually pay me to go to school. And I always liked school. And so I applied for this Atomic Energy Commission Fellowship and got that. And my mother was an obvious factor in that. The second thing that my family influenced me with, and this is very personal, I was born with what's called an essential tremor. And I'm sure other people in this room have faced health challenges. My hands, a year ago, I could not hold out like that. And these guys around the table would test. If I was going to drink a glass of water, it took two hands. If I drank coffee, I drank it from a tippy cup. And eventually my tremor got, and I made the decision in life that this was not going to interfere with my life, that I was going to move forth, do the things that I wanted to do. And then about 5 years ago, it got to the point where I couldn't write. And then it got to the point where eating was becoming difficult. And I had been researching an operation that they do to cure it, which in my case, it obviously worked. It's called deep brain stimulation. They put, you'll see I have two bumps on my head. They put two rods in your brain down to what the thalamus. And I have a pacemaker here, not for my heart, that provides electricity for that. And the electricity into the electrodes, touching the thalamus, deadens the active cells in the thalamus. And I'll tell you, I went from like this to like that. And it literally was a miracle. And you are awake for this operation because there are no nerve cells in the brain. And they want to test the system. And I had mine done at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And, you know, they have it off and you simulate drinking something and then they turn it on and the doctor said, "What do you think?" And I said, "It is a miracle." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I am taking this home with me. I'm walking out of here with it." And you get, this may be the most personal talk you've ever had. You get a little device like this. It's like a golf GPS system. I don't carry mine with me every day. You can if you want to. But you can turn it on and off with this device. For instance, I cannot be near large magnets because this will be effective. And I can't get an, well, if I get an MRI, it has to be somebody who's experienced to make sure that the head doesn't heat up because you've got metal in your head. But I can also adjust it. If I need to raise the voltage a little bit, I can do that by myself. Now, I do that when I play golf because even now, I still have a bit of a tremor. I raise it a little bit. It slows down the tremor. One of the side benefits, last year my handicap dropped 5 strokes. In all seriousness, if you know anybody with essential tremor or Parkinson's, this works for both. And prior to this, I was taking 5 medications, and they were heavy medications. There was not enough coffee in the world to keep me awake. I was constantly drowsy. I'm down to 1 med now, which does not make me drowsy.
How do you change the batteries on that?
Well, the battery in the pace, these, it's a typical pacemaker. It's good for about 8 to 10 years. Some people turn it off at night because it'll make the batteries last longer. What I found for me personally, I don't sleep as well with it off because when it's off, I'm just like, you know, so I'm moving around. So I just leave the darn thing on. And they would have to go in, do an operation, and replace the battery. Batteries in this are AA batteries. There's nothing unusual about it at all. But if you know anybody with those two illnesses, it is an absolute miracle. Anyway, essential tremor and Parkinson's.
Does that actually delay the progression of the disease like Parkinson's?
Yes.
To a degree, that's right.
Yes. It'll be now. I don't personally know anybody who's had it with had the treatment with Parkinson's, but I understand it is as effective. It will stop the random motion.
What's the name of the operation?
It's called deep brain stimulation. Okay. And the firm that makes the device is Medtronics, M-E-D-tronics.
Oh, great. The one they're going to tax.
Yes. Yeah, it will be taxed. But insurance covered my operation, and trust me, that operation is not cheap. Well, the second part of my life, and really the decade after graduation, is what I call my innovation phase. I left Penn State and went to a Department of Energy research laboratory, Argonne National Laboratory. And what we did is, if any of you use an iPod for music, you're too old, you don't do that. You have to put up with my sense of humor. No, the iPod uses a technology called nanotechnology. We developed that technology at Argonne. Electric vehicles, the batteries used in electric vehicles, which are long-lasting, high power, the ones used in hybrid cars, we developed that. Those laboratories were responsible for a lot of technology that was developed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The bad news, as somebody who worked at one of those, is that, like a lot of things, their budgets are being cut. And that has implications for us long-term in the technology innovation that we can do as a country. But I learned at the laboratory the importance of innovation. And I call it being on the leading edge, but not the bleeding edge. And there's a small difference between those two. I left there and went to work for a company in the Washington, D.C. area called Advanced Technology. They had a small practice doing work in nuclear power plants. What had happened was Three Mile Island, one of the primary causes of Three Mile Island was poor training of the control room operators, okay? Because the control room operators didn't understand exactly what was going on at Three Mile Island. And what had happened was there's what's called a pressure release valve that when the water boils, turns into steam, the valve opens up, lets the steam out. But when they tried to flood the core, there was a valve that was left open. So all the steam and all the water leaked out of that reactor, and that's what eventually led to the meltdown. Well, the industry, in fact, there's a group called IMPO, the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, which is headquartered here in Atlanta. It's down by a perimeter mall. They came out with guidance to upgrade the training programs at nuclear power plants. And the company I was with, we had done a lot of training program development for the Navy, for destroyers, nuclear submarines, etc. And the Department of Defense uses a very specific process called ISD, Instructional Systems Development, which we knew and understood. It's also a very expensive process. We knew shortcuts to be able to get through it but still have something quality. We upgraded the training programs, everybody in a power plant, mechanics, electricians, maintenance people, control room operators. Probably we did 70% of the nuclear plants in the country. We did Georgia Power, we did Vogtle, we did Florida Power and Light, Florida Power Corp. They no longer exist. They've been acquired, name changed since then, but throughout the whole country. And then as a part of that, this is where I learned about service and commitment. I worked with a group of ex-Navy nukes. A lot of the people in our power plants are ex-Navy nuclear submarine officers and enlisted men. And one of the things that Rickover did is he taught these guys about commitment and about doing what is absolutely necessary to get the job done first rate. They are very well trained. They know pumps, valves, heat exchangers inside and out, and they know about the power plant, the steam generator, the turbine generator. And I had, of the 300 people that ended up working for me there, I would say 220 were ex-Navy nukes. When I was there, when I first went there in 1982, my partner there was a guy by the name of Chris Allen. And this is part of commitment. Chris is still my business partner. We have partnered in three separate companies. We're still business partners. I've known him since 81. I've known him for 30-plus years at this point in time. And he is an ex-Navy nuke submarine guy. And you've heard the phrase, "Oh, Dark 30." It was in the movie having to do with Osama bin Laden. Well, I learned that phrase in the 1980s. And the way I learned it is because Chris was one of those guys. We were behind on a project, and the work needed to get done. Chris would get up at 4:30 in the morning. The McDonald's opened at 5 o'clock. He went there every morning. They knew exactly what Chris wanted. He'd walk in the front door. They had his coffee. They had his Egg McMuffin, put his money down, and walked out. He'd be at work at 5:10, and he would stay till whatever needed to be done was done. And that was the kind of commitment that you would see and that I benefited from and learned that that's what it really takes to be successful in life. Chris and I built that company from 82, it was a million, to 87, it was 30 million. We sold that company over dinner for cash on a napkin. No other paper written other than this amount on a piece of paper and closed the deal within 30 days. I was not one of the original founders, or most likely I would be on an island somewhere. As much as I enjoy you guys, I think I would be somewhere else. Chris and I, we stayed with the company for a while. We got acquired by a large company, Northrop Grumman, and they're a good company, but one of the lessons for me is I learned that big companies are not for me. And so after about 2 years, I just raised my hand and told Chris, I'm going to move on. And I moved on. And in the Washington area, you can consult if you have decent relationships and make a living doing that. And about 3 years later, Chris called me up and he said, "Do you want to start a company?" And I said, "How's tomorrow?" So he left and we started a second company, which we sold 4 years later to Duke Engineering, or Duke Power in Charlotte. And I said to Chris, "I'm not going there. I've been with a big company, done it, not going to go there." You know, so I left, and we were friends. There were no bad feelings about it. And then he called me up 2001, and he said the same thing. Do you want to start a company? And I said, "How's tomorrow?" So that's how we ended up starting the company we have right now. He and I are old school, meaning we understand about making a profit. We, for our business right now, and it's a consulting business, it's reasonably lucrative. I'm trying not to work at this point in time. Chris is younger than me. I'm 71, he's 63. He still wants to work. That's fine, but we typically make about a 30% operating income in the business that we're in right now, which is great. But in that phase, I really learned to play to my strength. And the strength was really one of knowing how to start a company from the ground up and build the thing up and create value in that company. Now I've gotten to what I'll call, and I haven't looked at time to know if I'm over or not. But by the way, seeing the money over there, this is the first time anybody ever paid to listen to me. This last phase for me is what I call pass it on. You know, passing on the skills and the abilities that you've developed along the way. And one of the great joys that I'm having right now is working with my son. My son works with Equifax, and he's been with them for a decade. And he's been managing their telecommunications market, Sprint, AT&T, or his clients, and he's moved over to the healthcare side. But he has come up with two or three ideas using data analytics, and that's what Equifax does. Analyze who's doing what, where, and leverage it for their customers. Anyway, these are ideas that Equifax is not in this business. They have no interest in it, so what Todd and I are doing, and the joy I'm having, is the opportunity to work with him to shape these ideas. And one of them is in the healthcare field, to be able to rapidly report the demographics of diseases. CDC collects the data and reports it, but it's typically about 3 months old. We have a way to get the data and report the data on a weekly basis of what diseases are occurring. Now, why is that useful? It's useful to pharmacies to know what medicines they should be stockpiling. It's useful for hospitals and practitioners to be able to predict and understand what they should be looking for, what kinds of things are occurring frequently. So we're going through this and defining this, and it's just an absolute joy to be able to do this with one of your children. And the last thing that I'll talk about is a hobby I took up. And I took up photography as the hobby. And I do these for friends in who live in Polo or live anywhere. These are printed on canvas. I have a place that prints them on canvas. And I'm not selling these. I'm just talking about it because I really like doing it. That's the Polo logo. When you become a member of the golf course, I don't know if they still do it or not, but you get a bottle of wine, and etched in gold is the guy playing polo, and that's our house. And then I put it in a synthetic frame here. Bob Roy has one. I never did like Manny, so he doesn't have one.
You're charging me for mine.
No, I've done about 8 to 10 of these. They're fun to do, and the other one that I do is a collage of pictures, and I honestly charge what these cost. If you want ever want one done, we lived in Reston, Virginia, for 24 years. And this was our house in Reston. Reston's a planned community with trails. That's downtown Reston. That's the Washington Monument. My wife was a school teacher for 28 years. That's where she taught. Reston was founded by Robert E. Simon. That's a statue for him. And I always put my name down here in the year so that I live on in perpetuity. So that's the one hobby I've developed. I've done that for our children, I'm doing one right now for a daughter-in-law, you know, where I get pictures of the local community she's from, the house she grew up in, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's my story. Thank you very much. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to be able to do this.
Any questions? Manny, why don't you ask him something?
Ask him?
Yeah.
I know him for so many years, and I never heard of
him. Good. That's good.
Yeah, he's a great friend. And when he said, you know, before the surgery, he mentioned 2 hands to hold water. It was scotch. It was not
real. Yeah, it was scotch.
Yes, that was true.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yay, yay. What a great...
I want to ask one question. What do you think of the future of nuclear energy in America?
Oh, I
future of nuclear energy. Go ahead and talk into the mic here.
I think there definitely is going to be a history or a future. And even in Georgia... there are licenses applied for additional units to be put at Vogtle, and I forget what the other one is. And I think eventually we'll get through the regulatory stuff and we'll move forth with those. And if you look across the country at the utilities that already have a nuke site, the vast majority of them are moving forth in some way. Now, money is an issue because... the way the electric utility revs are written, you know, it takes them 3 to 5 years to build this plant, and you're not making any money on that investment. And Mark looks like he has a view on it.
Yeah, I have a question. You just brought it up. I've toured Plant Vogtle, and if none of you have ever done that, you ought to do that. It's hard to get in. I mean, you have to get Social Security. I mean, it is so – you'll be amazed by the security there. But anyway – I support it. Think that we will not be able to, in Georgia, turn the electricity on in 20 years if we don't continue to do this. People don't want to hear that, but that's the truth, I believe. But one of the questions I have is the storage of the spent rods is a major concern for a lot of people. I was told, and I'd like to see what you know, but I was told that France has developed technology that the rods that we currently store, that there's enough energy left in them that France has developed technology to recycle those and continue to get, so by doing so, you don't have to dispose of them, so you get additional energy. Have you heard anything about technology that could be commercialized here to take that on?
Yeah, there is. And we have, country, two issues that have not been addressed. Number one is we have a designated permanent disposal facility in Nevada.
And we spent billions on it already, too.
Yeah. Spent a lot of money. Yeah, obviously people know about it. Yucca Mountain. But we can't get over the darn political barriers to get the stuff out there. And if there's anything that is really dangerous in a nuclear power plant, it's storing all that used fuel right there in water.
By people, close to people.
Yeah, right. And a lot of those facilities, inside a nuclear power plant, there is a containment facility, and it's solid concrete. It's like and I've forgotten the thickness of the wall, so don't hold me to this. It's like a 24-foot thick concrete wall, steel line. That's not true of the storage facility. They are not protected in that way. So there is risk there. A terrorist was going to go to a nuclear power plant. I don't think you'd go to the plant. You'd put an airplane in where the stuff is stored. Now, there is technology to recycle. We don't recycle because of the plutonium issue. When you run a nuclear power plant and you use uranium, you produce plutonium along the way. And of course, paranoid is the only word I can think of. We're so paranoid about that we do not permit recycling. And a lot of that stuff could be recycled and reused rather than thrown out.
So we do have the technology, it's just that once again, the political process is stopped. My thought was to have a just commercialize it in the state and allow business to take that and allow that to happen, but I didn't know about the plutonium part of it.
The technology was developed in the States, not in France.
I was told that it was in France.
France is doing it.
Yeah.
But it was developed, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
40 years ago.
Yeah, the technology was developed here a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We gave it away.
Yes, Chad? Quick.
You were talking about Admiral Rickover's training program for the nukes. Are the current trainees still held to the same standards that Admiral Rickover requires?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't have anything really close about it, but by and large, our military gets, across the board, gets superior technical training. Now, we have a few guys in the Air Force that are cheating, that I'm sure you've heard about, that control the buttons, but outside of that, they're good men, they're mm-hmm. well-educated.
What do they do with all those? They store the Polaris submarines in a place up in Washington State, mothball. Those nuclear reactors are still sitting there. Are they still usable, or are they...
For the submarine ones?
Yeah.
No, they're the power plant in a submarine, and don't hold me to this number either, is real small. It's about 35 megawatts.
Yeah.
Our plants are 1,000 megawatts, so it's a whole different scale. And they could undoubtedly do recycling and reuse of the fuel there.
It's just such a waste of a reactor, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have y'all ever seen a tried submarine?
Yeah.
My family has land down near Cumberland Island, South Georgia, that's near the nuclear
King's Bay.
And I've been out in a boat for a small, 20-foot boat, and see one of those things coming out of the water and coming towards you, because you can't get very far, but you can be 300 or 400 yards away, and it's just awe-inspiring to see how large these things. When I was in college, I worked at the base doing manual labor or whatever, but I could get near the smaller subs, but they have obviously armed guards, so you couldn't get too close if you worked there. But I never saw a Trident submarine out of the water, but I saw one in the water, and it's just awesome. So those things are really cool.
I'll tell you a little bit of an aside about the Navy and how creative the guys can be. You remember the toy Slinky?
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, we all had one. Well, that was invented by a guy from my hometown, Altoona, Pennsylvania. He was a machinist mate in the Navy, and he was doing work as a machinist mate would with a lathe. And he noticed these curly pieces of metal came off. And then he started to play with them. He left the Navy after World War II, came back to Altoona, built every piece of equipment from the ground up to manufacture those, and then went into business sometime in the 1950s and built that thing up till it was one. I mean, when I was a kid, you had to have one.
Everybody had one.
Yeah. Now they're in plastic, so they don't... I'm sure you remember they used to get them curled or they'd stretch out, something like that.
Terrific. Thanks, John. Okay. Appreciate it. Great job. Thank you. Thank you.
John is very kind. He used the word barrier when he talked about the... I thought of another two-word starting with B, but I won't tell you what that is. Keep my Christian witness as good as I can. In front of you guys, at least. When I'm around Mark, I kind of open up. But Mark and I were just talking about the importance of playing to your strength, and that a lot of times the processes that we've been told about in business actually play to your weaknesses. They try to discover what your weaknesses are and then make your weaknesses stronger. And I believe, like John does, that dog won't hunt. And that if you find where people's strengths are and can adjust the organization to accommodate those strengths and then take away the bondage and the barriers and the restrictions to keep people from working together, you can have an amazing company. And the experiments of my little companies, we've had a 32-hour work week for 10 years now, and it works
like you wouldn't believe. We get more done with our small group of people than a company 10 times our size in 32 hours. And a lot of what we try to do is what John mentioned, to allow people to do everything they can do or like to do or that they're good at, and not try to get in the way and manage from the top down. So great story, and I'm sure a lot of the guys here want to know when you go public with your company and you and Todd. So appreciate that. Great. Thanks for being here, and tell your neighbors about the meeting, and we'll have the next one in May, and have you a cup of coffee if there's still some left, or probably some eggs still left if you want to have some eggs. So, thanks for coming. See you next time.